You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, I'm joined by two guests, best-selling authors Kate Quinn and Janie Chang. Kate is the author of New York Times bestseller, The Alice Network, a Reese Witherspoon Book Club pick, and NPR Best Book of the Year. She's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Huntress, The Rose Code, and many more. Janie Chang is also a best-selling author. She's the author of Three Souls and national bestsellers, Dragon Springs Road and The Library of Legends. Kate and Janie recently teamed up to co-author a brand new book, The Phoenix Crown, which was just released on February 13th. Kate, Janie, and I recently sat down to talk all about it. When I talk to authors, I always walk away with so many powerful ideas and lessons about creativity, storytelling, communication, and so much more. And the most amazing part is that the lessons can be applied to so many different areas of my life. And this conversation with Kate and Janie is no different. Kate and Janie shared an incredible look at both of their respective creative processes and gave me a behind-the-scenes look at how they collaborated to write The Phoenix Crown together. This conversation is filled with so many actionable ideas on writing, creativity, collaboration, and more. And it's a powerful reminder of what's possible when remarkably talented individuals work together towards a common goal. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to best-selling authors Kate Quinn and Janie Chang. Kate and Janie, welcome to Everybody Pulls the Tarp.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kate, I want to start with you. I love to ask authors, you know, if you can remember that first moment that you wrote or told a story. Do you remember that moment?
I do, and it's fun because it's rather representative of the kind of stuff I would end up writing. I grew up in a house where history and books were a big part of it. My mother was a librarian with a degree in ancient and medieval history. So I grew up with stories about the past, and I had, you know, a Kings and Queens of England paper doll book. And I decided at age 7 that I was going to write a story based on English history. And so at 7, I wrote a 2-page story in pencil on the back of an unlined sheet of typing paper, which was all about the assassination of King Edward II of England. And it had bloodshed. It had a love triangle. There was a body and in a pool of blood and, you know, an evil scheming queen. It was very George R.R. Martin. And it was what I wrote at age 7. And I have to say that I haven't really necessarily gotten away from that whole idea since of a historical story, high drama, lots of women who are trying to probably grab power or, you know, grab independence from somebody who doesn't want them to have it. And, you know, maybe a love triangle and maybe a pool of blood.
Amy, what about you? Do you have a similar story that you can recall? Or was it totally different?
Nothing so dramatic, although I distinctly remember my 4th grade teacher telling my parents that I would be an author one day and thus entirely ruining my life because whatever other career I had, it just didn't seem equal to being an author. But I had 25 years in the computing science industry. I have a degree in computing science. And one day it just became soul destroying, not being able to write. And so I kind of rearranged my life and wrote the novel that I always thought that I would write, which was the story of my grandmother, who was forced to marry someone she didn't want to marry, an arranged marriage. And I also took a creative writing course that went for 1 year because I knew I had so much to learn and needed to accelerate that learning curve. So took this creative writing class, and very happily that first novel sold and I was on my way to becoming a career author.
Janie, I want to kind of double click on that for a second. You used the phrase rearrange your life to kind of go the direction that you wanted to go. So What did rearranging your life look like? What went into that process? How do you take that step? Because there are people listening who are thinking about things that they want to do that they're not doing today. And they're trying to wonder, how do they rearrange their life to get headed in the right direction? Talk about that for a moment.
Okay, full disclosure, I'm married. I do not have children, okay? I have a demanding cat, but it's not the same thing. I was also in the technology industry, which means that I had a lot of contacts there. And I went from corporate, which was not 9 to 5, it was more like 60-hour weeks. And I started freelancing. So I started freelancing as doing what I did best, which was to be a product marketing manager. And I worked for companies like Microsoft and Infonet, and I had clients in Silicon Valley. And all this time, I was just sort of backing away. But the freelancing allowed me to arrange my working life, because nobody cares if you're there or not, as long as you turn in the work on time. And that's how I did the rearranging. And I know that I was very, very lucky to be in an industry and at a time when this was possible.
That level of accountability that you had as a freelancer to turn in the work on time and be successful despite everything else, I have to imagine that as an author and as a creative, that probably continues to serve you well. That's kind of self-accountability that you can hold yourself to.
Yes. I mean, it really drives a strong work ethic. And it also means that I think you drive yourself a lot harder than you need to sometimes. I do respond to deadlines terribly, terribly well.
That's a good thing, I guess, in the writing and the publishing business. Kate, I'm curious if we kind of go back to that moment when you're 7 years old and you write that incredibly dramatic story with, you know, all the detail. What was next for you? So was there a point where somebody identified that, hey, this is something that you do better than the average person? Or was there a moment when you identified that this was a craft that you wanted to develop? Talk about that for a moment.
Pretty much from a very young age onward, I was never not writing stories. I wrote my first novel when I was 10 years old. I'd learned how to type. It was 121 double-spaced pages of pure awful. It lives under the bed. It will never see the light of day. And the thing is, though, is it whetted that appetite in me for telling stories. This became something that satisfied me deeply. And for really the next, all through middle school, high school, and then college, I was doing other things. I was studying other things. You know, I was a full-time student. And then eventually I was working with, you know, a full-time 9-to-5 job. I was always finding ways to write stories on the sideline. And sometimes that's really hard. You do have to, if this is what you want to do, find ways to cram it in. I remember days when I had a full course load as a student and 3 work study jobs. The only time I had to write was weekends. So I would wait till weekends and then I would write for 10 hours a day, Saturday and 10 hours Sunday, because that was the only time I had, but that was what made me happy fundamentally. And you do have to be, I think, made happy by storytelling if you're going to have a chance of wanting to do this as a job. But it was also the fact that I did hear at some point that classic phrase that you need to put in 10,000 hours to get good at something. I did get published young and I wrote a lot of books young, but this is also because I started my 10,000 hours really young. I started at age 10 writing novels. I was never not writing a novel after that. I have something like 10 novels under the bed that will never see the light of day. But I know none of those was wasted work because that was me teaching myself how to write. Unlike Janie, I did not do a creative writing course to help, you know, cut some of that work short. I think if I had, maybe I would not have had to reinvent the wheel myself, but I'm pretty much entirely self-taught. I think that you can be. All you need to do is read a lot and write a lot. You learn about books by reading. You learn about writing by writing. And that's what I did. And I did have to put in a lot of words before I really sort of figured out how to do this. But I don't regret any of that. And I loved every moment of doing that. It's just that I do very much believe that there are no shortcuts necessarily to getting good at something. You are going to have to put in the wrench time. And I did a lot of wrench time. And that's one of the reasons people said, you know, it's like, oh, you're published so young. I was 26 when I got an agent. And my agent said, my God, you're a baby. And I wondered if she was not going to pick me up after all. But the thing is that I had been already writing for so long that it felt like I had at least put in the wrench time, even if I was young. And I do really believe, you know, writing is about inspiration, and people talk about the inspiration a lot, but they don't also talk about the fact necessarily that you are never going to get anything written and you're never going to get good at writing unless you put your butt in the chair for all those hours that it takes to get good.
I am curious, when you think about kind of all those wrench hours that you put in, was there something back then that you worried about a lot or you fixated on a ton that now you just say to yourself, I wish I didn't spend so much time worried about that? Not necessarily not working on it, but just something I wish I didn't worry about so much.
Oh, that's a good question. I think that I worried that I would miss my slot. You know, like if it was a certain book, like would its time be passed? Like, I think with historical fiction, which I write, historical eras come in and out of fashion. And I remember worrying, you know, I wrote a book about ancient Rome and I began it. It was the year that Gladiator won Best Picture. And that's probably going to date me, I'm sure. But I thought it's like years went by and I thought, are people not going to be interested in stories about ancient Rome, you know, in any time for me to actually get this book publishable? And what I didn't realize then is what I certainly do now is that fads in books, like anything else, come in cycles. And if Rome goes out, at some point it's going to come back in, hopefully. So what I've learned now that I bit my nails about a lot then is that maybe it is not time for a certain story to be published now, but it doesn't mean that its chance is gone forever. You can put it under the bed and maybe bring it out later when, you know, one hit runaway novel makes a historical era popular all over again, and suddenly readers want this kind of story, and then I have something maybe that's waiting.
That's really interesting. You know, I see a variation of that when it comes to these conversations that I'm having every single week with high performers from sports, entertainment, the creative world, business, in that I'll listen back to the conversation that we're having right now, and I'll look back at the transcript, and I'll jot down sometimes kind of my favorite takeaways or lessons. And then I'll look back at it in 6 months or a year or 2 years, and something will kind of compel me to go back to the conversation. And the lessons I take away are totally different. It's amazing how the same piece of content can change in its relevance or its overall kind of importance in the zeitgeist, right? Based upon whatever else is going on. That's a really, really important point, Kate. I hadn't necessarily thought about it the way that you had put it with books.
Well, it's one of those things. Janie and I are both huge sci-fi fans. It's not what we write, but we both love it. And it's wonderful when you look at classic science fiction, you'll see it all the time. It's like that some book that was written maybe back in the 60s or the 50s is still relevant today because the issues that they raised, which maybe seemed impossible back then, are very much possible now, or that are very, very relevant today. Mm-hmm. Even when back then it looked pie in the sky. And like, you can look at things where you wonder, did you have a time machine? Were you looking ahead into the future? And that's one of the things I think that is marvelous about books, is that it is a way that you can examine the issues of the present through the lens of the future for science fiction. And for Janie and me, we examine it through the lens of the past, because you can look at issues that people faced in the past and realize that these issues are still being faced by people today. And that's what makes historical fiction relevant.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm one of these folks who, you can see a lot of books behind me and I read a lot of books. I went through a long phase where I only read nonfiction. For whatever reason, I was drawn kind of only to nonfiction. And I have to say, thanks to the two of you, historical fiction kind of brought me back to fiction. There's something about historical fiction that I really enjoy. I find that it's able to transport me to different times and different places that challenge my thinking and enable me to think more creatively. And I have all of you historical fiction authors out there, and you two are two of the best at it, to thank for kind of helping me rediscover fiction. But that was something that I always kind of went through, or that I went through as a reader, which I've always thought was kind of interesting. And I love historical fiction for those reasons. Janie, I want to go back to what you had said about the creative writing course compared to Kate, who described herself as more self-taught. When you think about that creative writing course work, aside from like the technical side of writing, was there one thing that you learned that you maybe think about more today than other aspects?
I think, first of all, a really good reason for me to have taken the course at all was that by plunking down the thousands of dollars that it cost, it gave me permission to put myself first and put my dreams first. Because I think for a lot of people, especially women, and especially if we have families, if we have mortgages to pay, we tend to put all those other things first. And this was my way of saying, now is the time, I'm going to do this. Okay. And one of the great things that I learned in this particular creative writing program is that there's more to it than just writing. If you want to be a successful author, there's the craft of writing, there's the business of writing, and there's the community of writing, which is to support your fellow authors whenever you can. The business of writing, which is to realize that there are things that you need to do as an author that your publisher is not going to do for you. And then the craft of writing, which is always to hope that you can work at it and improve, that every book should be a better book than the previous. And you're constantly balancing all of these three aspects.
Community of writers and authors that you mentioned there. I want to kind of like hone in on that a little bit. As I've gotten the opportunity to talk to so many authors over the years, including some of which that I know both of you know, including Madeline Martin and others, I am continuously impressed at that word community, the community of how you all work together and support one another. Kate, I know that you wrote a book with Madeline and four other authors. The six of you wrote a book together, which is just remarkable in terms of like collaboration. And as I think about that, what is this community of authors? Why is it so special? How do you create it? And how can people listening who are doing other things create communities around what they do to support one another?
Well, you can find community, and it is a little difficult to put that together as a newbie in the field, because writing is very solitary, and it is going to be something you, unless you are collaborating, that you're doing alone. And it is tough at first to maybe find that community, but this is why places like conferences are wonderful places to meet people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to critique groups and you can find people that way, communities of readers like Goodreads, though that's more for readers than for writers. You can find community of writers on X or Twitter and in various other online spaces. We have a community of writers just simply because we're all represented by the same agent. And so, you know, we sort of came together because we realized that we wanted a space to be able to talk to each other and about the industry and to support each other behind the scenes. And the internet, thank goodness, makes it much easier these days once you have these connections to maintain them, because there seems to be the rule that you never live near anybody who you would like to, you know, regularly have coffee with in the business. It doesn't ever seem to happen that you live geographically close to one another. But once you have that community, there really is such supportiveness. And it does come about because there are things that we have in common as writers that it's very weird to the outside world. Like, I can bond instantly with a writer I have never met before just over a question as simple as, how much do we all hate copy edits? And the groans go up. Or what is that, you know, like, what FBI watch list do you think you're on because of something that you've Googled? And then you have, everyone has the story about how you had to Google, you know, how does one weaponize smallpox? Or you Googled how to kill a small child and make it look like an accident, which a friend of mine did Google and then wondered, oh, for God's sake, I wonder if the police are going to show up in an hour. And this is all for research, but a writer's Google search history is a very scary thing. And these are things that we have in common. And, you know, add to it things like the deadline binges. What's the nuttiest thing you've ever done for research? What are you like when you're 1 week from your deadline and your house looks like it's been shelled by Messerschmitts because you haven't done anything but your book for the longest time? And this creates a bond with people just because you're insiders and you can bond with people, even strange writers, immediately over stuff like this. And it's a wonderful feeling when you ultimately do so much of your work alone, which is why community is important. And it's why, too, that when you hit the hard times, you know, you had a book idea that didn't sell, you're starting to think, maybe I need to find a new agent and I've never done that before. It's helpful to have a community to reach out to. So you have people who say, hey, I've gone through this too. And let me tell you how it turned out for me. Because the thing about, again, being a writer is that we are encouraged to put ourselves out there on social media now. it being so much a part of the landscape. And you know, we know how social media is. You only broadcast the top 5% of your life and the things that look good. And so you may think if you're all alone in your study that, you know, no one else has ever had an editor pass on a book idea. No one else has ever bitten their nails down to the quick wondering if they need to change agents. But then you, if you have a community you can reach to, you realize everybody else has gone through some of the same things. They just haven't talked about them publicly. So that's where the community helps and why building it is so important, so that you have people to support in their moments of triumph. They will support you, but also to have people to go to when you need help and you feel like it's hard to reach out publicly.
I would say that it was really, if not for community, my first book probably wouldn't have sold, because I went to a conference and a very established author lobbied for the woman who would eventually become my agent to read the first two chapters of my work in progress. And he didn't have to do that. He was being helpful. And by the same token, an author who was an early reader of my manuscript, she actually went and sort of berated the woman who would eventually become my editor in Canada and said, "You've got to read Janie's book." And I try to pay it forward because they did so much for me to get me started.
Paying it forward, it's an idea I think that we all have to think about. I mean, I fundamentally think that when anybody's achieved any measure of success in anything, that you have a responsibility to kind of, you know, you take the elevator to the top or halfway up and you got to send it back down a couple floors to lift someone else up. And I think that we all have people that we can point to that have helped us up. And I think it's important for all of us to help others up as well. How do you avoid, so you build this community and you have this thriving community. How do you avoid, or how do you like reduce the impact of maybe any comparison game where you're, you know, I don't feel as far along as this person, or this person, you know, I could have written this and had more success than they, like, how do you avoid that? Because human nature sometimes is this issue where that we have with comparing ourselves to others that are at different places of their journeys.
If I could answer that, I think that when you're starting out, it is very, very painful to see someone else's success, because you think, exactly as you say, could I have written that book? Could I have done more? But the more books that you write, the more you come to the bottom line, which is, as an author, there's actually not that much you can do to move the needle in terms of sales. And that so much success in our society is defined by sales volume, by how much money you've earned, by the size of the advances that you have. And you can go crazy. It's sort of like, oh, I hit the Globe and Mail bestseller list. Wait a minute. Will I hit the USA Today bestseller list? Wait a minute. Will I get on the New York Times bestseller list? You could go absolutely crazy. And the only thing you have control over is the quality of your writing. And that's actually what will drive your success more than anything else, I believe, is that eventually that word will get around that this is an author who's worth reading. So, I mean, I've been through all that painful cycle, and I sort of come to this quiet, maybe not zen, because I still go off into, you know, like crazy phases of need to turn in the book and this book is crap and no one will ever buy a book from me again. We still go through that. This is where community comes in, you know, talks you off the ledge. But I am a lot more philosophical about what is it that I can do, that the envy is just not worth it.
Yeah, it's something where it's hard to avoid a little bit of envy, but you don't let it consume you. And it's easier to do that once you know a little bit more about the business and realize that, for one thing, success is cyclical. You do not have a career that is going to be a long, steady upward rise. There are cycles and ups and downs in every career. And someone may hit the best New York Times bestseller with one book, and then maybe their next book hardly sells at all. You have no idea. And so therefore, if you are envious of someone else's success, you know, next time around, their next book may not do as well. And likewise for you, just because your book did not sell well, it doesn't mean your next won't hit it out of the park. These things are very much a roller coaster, and it's helpful to think of it as a marathon rather than a sprint. And the other thing too is that I truly believe, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Someone else's success does not take away from your own. If a reader, you know, loves one book about, you know, women spies in World War II, that does not mean that that's the only book about women spies in World War II that they're ever going to read. In fact, it's much more likely that reading one has created an appetite in them and they will say, like, what else can I read that's like this? And in that case, I am only too happy if you have read mine to then give you the name of five other authors I know who have written something in the same wheelhouse and then give them a boost as well. You know, what will ultimately make all of our careers more successful is creating a demand for more books, creating readers who want more. And that is the kind of thing that it is, the whole attitude of, I want people to read my book, but no one else's, you know, that is not fundamentally going to help anyone in this business.
And can I point out sort of like the ultimate example of this is, how many books have you read about Anne Boleyn, right? There is actually a website, a blog called Anne Boleyn Novels, and the banner says Anne Boleyn in Fiction, the head that launched those books. There's, you know.
It really is true that, and I hadn't, I mean, you both know the Everybody Pulls the Tarp story and that everything that I kind of zero in on kind of in the way I aspire to live my life is to be a tarp puller, as I say, to go above and beyond what's expected of me, to lift others up, to never say that's not my job, to pitch in and help regardless of what the job description, you know, says or is expected of me. And it's really interesting to think about it through the prism that both of you just described, right? That if one author in a genre or just writ large in, you know, an author succeeds, it creates more readers. It creates more interest in that genre. And every time you go to the bookstore to look for that author's book, there's other books nearby that are related or adjacent, have adjacencies. It's the same thing when you buy books online on Amazon or wherever, right? There's a way to kind of create this web. And the more that you individually do to contribute to the web, it serves everybody else around you. I think that's really powerful.
There's a lot of advertising that goes that way too. I mean, think of the way the algorithms will work. If you liked this book, you will like this one. There are these, you know, strings that are already being connected between books that are similar. And it hopefully does help people, you know, find more things that they like. And so as authors, we're asked all the time, what books do you recommend? What other books, if we like yours, can we read? It then helps other writers and it helps the readers to be able to have a list that you can point to say, yes, absolutely, I can curate a list for you that is this kind of book, and I think you will like it. And it's a real pleasure when I recommend a book of a colleague and someone else then says, I had never heard of that and I loved their book. Thank you. Then you've done someone a favor beyond just the, you know, having provided a book of your own. If I love it when I can provide something else that someone then says, I found a new favorite author. Thank you. And it's like, yes, that is what I want to do.
Well, going back to what you said about you loved reading nonfiction and that historical fiction has brought you back to novels again. And I just want to say that for a lot of us, we get huge satisfaction writing historical fiction by knowing that readers have said, you know, and you got me really interested in this era of history. So now I've gone and I've like bought the actual biography. I've bought the actual history book on. And we like to say that historical fiction is the gateway drug to history.
That is an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, there is no question that when I read historical fiction about a particular time or it features certain people or types of people, that I then seek out other books or other material on those types of things. I look at documentaries on Netflix or Amazon Prime. It's so much more interrelated than I think I ever imagined before we had this conversation today. Now, I want to kind of explore both of your, well, before we talk about your creative process, you talked about the power of recommending books. And one of the things that I like to do from time to time is go back to all the guests on this podcast and ask them to recommend books that have either inspired them or that they enjoy. And with the authors, I always have a rule that I will promote the books that you wrote, but for the recommendation list, I want you to give me something that is written by somebody else. So I'm going to come back to you guys at some point soon because we're in the process of updating that list and ask you guys for recommendations of books that are not written by you. And it's powerful. Now that you guys have kind of told me how you look at it from your vantage point, it's going to be even more fun for me to kind of piece together the latest version of this list. I want to fast forward a little bit or move forward a little bit towards your creative process. So I'm curious, you know, Kate and Janie, I want to understand kind of what's similar about both of your creative processes now that you both know each other so well. What's different about each of your respective creative processes? And then to work on a book together after most of your time is spent kind of in solitude writing on your own, I'm curious to understand how you marry up different creative processes. So maybe we'll start with you, Kate. Kate, take me through, kind of paint the picture for me as to your creative process. How would you describe it?
I tend to start whenever I have an idea with something that has given me a light bulb moment. Generally speaking, for me, that is either a woman or a group of women in history who have done something truly astounding and that make me think, wow, I want to know more. I want to write more. I can't believe I didn't know more about this. The world should know about this. And then that makes me want to write a book about whoever these women or women are. And then I will start with the historical facts, the research. That's the framework that the story will hang on. So I have as complete a picture as possible of how, what the history is behind it, and then layer the fictional elements on top of that and realize what, you know, what kind of story can I hang on this framework. And at that point, I do a lot of outlining. I do a lot of ruminating on, you know, okay, how is this book going to go? By the time I start drafting, I generally will have a very good idea of what happens, say, in the first act, a pretty good idea of what happens in the second act. And in the third act of the book, I probably know where I want it to end up, but I'm not entirely sure how I get there. And that's because the roadmap, as soon as you start to write, is going to change on you. Much like the old saying, no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. No outline is going to survive first contact with the drafting process. So things will change on the way, but that's also part of the fun. And then I draft. And I think one of my main bits of advice for any new writers is your first draft is going to be terrible. And I think it was Nora Roberts who said, I can fix a bad page, I can't fix a blank page. So you just have to get those pages down so then later you can fix them. And that's what I navigate by.
That's great. That's powerful. I want to make a note here. You can fix a bad page, but you can't fix a blank page. Janie, I want to go to you now. How is your creative process similar to Kate's? How is it different? And then I'm going to tackle this big question, which I've been wondering for a long time. How did two well-established, extremely talented authors then merge those two into a novel together? Janie, take me through your creative process, how it's similar to Kate, how it's different first.
Starts with coffee, and I think that's the same for Kate. And we are both history nerds, so it does require a lot of research. But there's all these people often come up to me and say, well, I've got this great idea for a story. And I have those moments too. I have this great idea for a story. But then you go into the research and you think, does this idea have legs? Is it going to be, will I have enough passion for it that it's going to sustain me for 100,000 words of writing? And probably about 150 by the time you're through, because you ripped out so many sections. And so is the germ of the story sustainable? And sadly, for those of us who want to talk about women who try and battle their way through lack of agency, there is any number of historical time settings where you can find a story. And then, like Kate, I can draft it out. But also, like Kate, I've been in the position of handing in a book 2 years after the book proposal and crossing my fingers that my editor does not remember the book proposal I sent 2 years ago, because this is not the same book anymore. So in that way, it's similar. But actually, I find that every new book is its own version of hell. You think you've got the process under control, and something happens, you know, it goes out the window.
That is just awesome, Janie. I mean, what a candid way of looking at something, that people pick up a book. I always say, you know, I love going to bookstores and I love taking my daughters to bookstores. And when you stand in a bookstore, you're looking at something that on the surface seems so simple, but at its core is the result of tens of thousands of people who put in tens of thousands of hours, who grinded when it was hard to grind through and went through hell and back, as you just described, Janie, just to kind of like force something out into the universe. And then some people sit on a train or on a plane or on a beach or on their couch and they read it. But it represents so much more. And I think that is kind of like what the two of you are describing here. And what I love about these conversations is that we kind of unearth that. And I'm curious, you take this hell that you described, Janie, and this battle plan, which doesn't make it through first contact, as Kate described. And now the two of you have to kind of merge this together. So I'm curious, The Phoenix Crown, your new book that the two of you co-authored, how did the idea to work together on this book come to be? And take me through the process and what's different, besides maybe the obvious, of just two established, very talented, successful authors working together on a singular work.
It was Kate's fault. She started it.
I had always wanted to write a book about the San Francisco earthquake, which is a really fascinating natural disaster. And I thought, when I was doing some research, there's sort of so much there that would make a great story. But the more I looked at it, the more I thought, you know, I really think this is going to need a Chinatown heroine, because Chinatown is such a huge, vibrant part of San Francisco history. It was completely destroyed during the earthquake and the following fires. And it seemed to me that most of the fiction I had read about the San Francisco earthquake only dealt with Chinatown, if at all, in a peripheral way. And it seemed like it was so deserving of having, you know, a really central role in a book. And I thought, well, I wonder, you know, I approached Janie and I just tentatively said, are you at all interested in this kind of this period of history? And I was, you know, just heaved a huge sigh of relief. And she said, yes, this is really fascinating.
And then we thought, back to that collaboration process, the big goal that we had was, sure, we wanted to write a great novel together, but we wanted to be friends afterwards too. That mattered. That really kind of mattered more. So we knew that we had to have a story that we both agreed on. And we got together a few times and put together a book proposal for our agent, who went and pitched to our publishers. And it does kind of help that we have the same agent and the same publisher. And then we knocked it out. And our favorite tool was spreadsheets.
This book could not have been written without Google Spreadsheet. We both realized that we were going to have to be a bit more organized if we were working together than we would be probably individually. So we really broke it down in terms of, we didn't want to have to worry about creating a unified style. So therefore, we knew the book was going to involve two heroines. Janie would write all the scenes from her heroine's point of view. I would write all the scenes from my heroine's point of view. And that meant that we just decided, well, it'll be alternating chapters. So therefore, we pulled up a Google spreadsheet and we laid it out in a pretty much in Excel, that she had the odd number of chapters, I had the even, and we knew exactly what events and how much time would pass in each chapter. And therefore, we could look at exactly the way that they dovetailed. And it meant that we could therefore write our own chapters, and then without needing to have reference to the other. And then as soon as they were done, we would throw them up in a shared Google Drive so the other could read.
I'm so fascinated by all this. And you guys have been so generous with your time. And as we begin to wrap up, I'm just thinking about what you just said there about this idea. And I think this applies to almost anything, that when you pull someone else in to a process, it almost is a forcing function for you to get more organized or for you to learn your process better. And I know I discovered that myself with my own craft as it pertains to this podcast and the content. First 40 episodes, I did without an editing team. And I had some people who helped out to kind of help me get this thing off the ground. However, once we got to right around episode 41 or so, we brought on an editing team, and it really forced me to refine my process and approach and dial everything in. And I actually think that that probably applies to almost anything.
It's one of those things where we got this book done on a tight timeline. And part of that was imposed by the publisher because we had a certain date in mind for publication. But the other part, and the reason why we did it well, is that we are willing to negotiate on our own behalf. You know, it's like, all right, I'm not staying up another hour. I'm just not doing it to finish this scene tonight. But when you know that you have a writing partner waiting, you know, to see what you're going to do with that chapter so that, you know, then they can dovetail it into the chapter that they're going to write, you end up thinking, I would let myself down, but I will be damned if I let Janie down. So you will stay up that extra hour. You will make sure that that chapter is uploaded at 1:30 in the morning. So as soon as she gets up, she's got it ready to go.
Not only that, but, you know, normally you could leave a chapter kind of raw, but then I would think, oh my goodness, and Kate will read this as soon as I upload it to Google Docs. So, you know, I better go over it with a little bit of polishing first. So we ended up compiling a complete manuscript that was maybe not as crappy as it could have been.
I love that. Maybe not as crappy as it could have been.
Yeah, that's the tagline that should go on the cover, right?
Yeah. You know, I always wonder where you guys dig up those beautiful quotes for the covers of books. I hope that doesn't end up on a cover of one of your future novels. I'm sure it won't. You both are so extraordinarily talented. It's remarkable for me, you know, I'm so grateful to have these beautiful conversations, to dig into your stories and understand more about not what you do, but how you do it and how it all comes together. The lessons you shared in this conversation are so powerful and apply to anything. I can't wait to read The Phoenix Crown. It's out everywhere folks can get books or listen to books. Kate Quinn, Janie Chang, thank you so much for spending some time with me. You two are forever part of the Everybody Pulls TARP community. TARP pullers certified for sure.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much. Take care. All right, everyone. If you loved this episode, you might also enjoy my interview with Aaron Mattson. In January of 2023, University of North Carolina named Aaron its field hockey head coach. At the time, she was just 22 years old, and it was just 2 months after her graduation from UNC as a student. Suddenly, she was the head coach for the same program she had just finished starring in as a student athlete. And are you ready for this? In her first year as a head coach, she led UNC to a national title, becoming the youngest D1 college head coach to win a national championship. Be sure to find my conversation with Aaron in your podcast app. It will get you ready to take bold risks and defy conventional wisdom, no matter where you are in your personal or professional journey. Check it out and let me know what you think. Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of TARP pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today's a great day to pull the TARP. I am rooting for you. See you next time.